And you believe, Ken, that many ancient books were deliberately excluded from the Old and New Testaments. How come?
Well, I think you briefly alluded to the concept of, for example, encounters, let's put it that way,
yeah,
with beings from beyond our world. You may call them extraterrestrial. I'll call them non-terrestrial.
Okay.
Okay. We'll use a neutral term because extraterrestrial, let's face it, is pretty loaded. And of course, in the scholarly world, that sort of thing, for some strange reason, is frowned upon. Can you imagine? Scholars don't like to talk about such subjects. But okay, we'll talk about it.
We will.
Yeah.
Yes, we will.
There are multiple allusions. You mentioned one in Genesis, the passage about the Nephilim, as they're called, who apparently came down, visited this planet, and spawned, according to these banned books, a whole race of beings having cohabited with Earth women. There's only a brief reference to it in the book of Genesis, Genesis 6:4, which says that the Nephilim, Nephilim hayu ba'aretz, that's the original Hebrew, the Nephilim, whoever they were in the land, in the earth, in those days. And afterward, when the sons of God, the Hebrew says, B'nei Elohim, went to the daughters of men and had children by them, they were the heroes of old, men of renown. And then the text just moves on.
And yeah, a very short passage. And it makes you wonder, what's this mean?
Sure. It's begging for a backstory. And one thing we can say about biblical literature is it seems to be deliberately written like this, that it is sparse. It doesn't mince words. It wants the reader to jump into the text and supply things. Or I'm sure in antiquity, they would hear it recited, and then they would sit around the campfire, and they would ask questions, and what does it mean, and how do we interact with this story? In a way, it's kind of a very modernist approach to literature, because rather than telling you everything you're supposed to know, it demands the reader to get in there and interact with it, and hence all the backstories, entire books that expound on all this stuff to explain what's it doing in Genesis, but for some reason, the sages and the keepers of the religious canon just weren't too comfortable with all that speculation, so they systematically excluded it from what we call our Bible today.
Do we have the ability to find out exactly what might be in those excluded texts?
Well, a lot of these have come down to us over the centuries in translation. The original Semitic versions were systematically discarded, banned, as it were. I was pleased to take part in a whole History Channel documentary called Banned from the Bible. Those texts, most of them have come down, but in translation. They were translated to Greek and Slavonic and Ethiopic and multiple other languages. Then the originals were lost, and the scholarly world wondered how many of these had been doctored down through the centuries, how many of them were authentic, when they were composed, who composed them. Well, numbers of them have, in fact, surfaced now, at least in fragments, in, can you imagine, the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing stuff. We have, for example, the book of First Enoch, at least in fragments, among the Dead Sea Scrolls. The book of Jubilees, very important, among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Fragments from what looks like a series of these books called the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Tobit, the letter of Jeremiah, the book of Jesus ben Sirah, all represented, at least in fragments, among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this work continues to go on. In fact, only recently there are new efforts at preservation among the thousands of Dead Sea Scroll fragments that still have yet to be fully analyzed and pieced together. This is the world's biggest jigsaw puzzle.
What do you think it means about these non-terrestrials, as you call them? Who are they? What are they?
Yeah, well, these texts, along with the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves, are full of what we call apocalypticism, an apocalyptic mentality, the end is near. They're also very mystical. They're messianic. And whoever these people were that wrote them, and there's great debate about who the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls were. Forget about who wrote the Bible. Who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls? There's no consensus about that either. But whoever these people were, they had a sense that the universe is really, the only way I can put it, is dense with intelligence. Just dense with intelligence, with what they perceive as intermediaries and mediators and ideas that are really foreign to Jewish monotheism down to this day. Again, I teach in Judaic studies, and I can assert just how monotheistic Judaism is to this day. There isn't any place in the religion for multiple intermediaries. There is one God, and that is the heart and soul of it. So even to speculate about, you know, angels and these strange Nephilim is a little bit dangerous in the traditional Orthodox Jewish mind down to this day. And to be honest, it's actually less dangerous to speculate about the non-terrestrial being potential here than it is just to call them angels.
It's pretty safe to say that some creatures, call them angels, call them non-terrestrials, call them ETs, something visited this planet a long, long time ago. Is that pretty accurate?
That's what these people believed. And as scholars, we can't get inside their minds. We can't ask them, what exactly did you see? But we can say that there had to have been an enormous fund of folklore that recorded such visitations. I like the idea of Jacques Vallée and his multidimensional visitation hypothesis. Even he is looking at the idea of religious experience being interrelated, and whether you call it the ET phenomenon or some angelic religious phenomenon, when a person enters into a deep meditative state of consciousness, it seems to open up various dimensions of reality. And from my perspective, it's really tragic that scholarship gets so compartmentalized, especially today. And we've got literary researchers galore, biblical scholars galore, who never even talk with experts on the mind, on psychic phenomena, for example. It's like verboten. You don't know there. Just words on page. That's all it is. And I think we're missing something. We need to be a lot more talk about multidimensional in our scholarship.
Yeah. Is it possible, Ken, that the authors of these old works just merely made up these stories? They were great novelists of their time. Could they have just done that?
Well, anything's possible. And I'm sure a lot of detractors are going to say, yeah, these were just fantasized. They were novelists, etc. But what Jacques Vallée and others have done is noted the frequency of similar types of stories, of themes, of archetypes that seem to course through these works in the Jewish world and also in surrounding cultures. I'm drawn to one Dead Sea Scroll in particular that was found up on top of Masada that has the most chilling description of some kind of craft, as a matter of fact.
Oh, you have to tell us this one.
Oh, yeah. As well as non-terrestrial beings. It's called the Song of Sabbath Sacrifices, and it was found, of all places, on top of a rocky precipice in the Judean desert. I've been there many times. I've lived in the land. It's called Masada, or Matsada in Hebrew. This was the stronghold of the anti-Roman rebels.
They held themselves up there for days, didn't they?
Months, in
months.
Fact. And
when they all died, right?
When the Romans finally battered down the walls, they were greeted by a stony silence, and all 960 freedom fighters, we're told by Josephus, had slain each other by slitting each other's throats, and the last person falling on his own sword, just a grisly thing, because they refused to surrender the Romans. And this rock, this place called Matsada, lay unexcavated for the better part of 2,000 years, was not excavated until the 1960s, when the great Israeli archaeologist Yigael Yadin took a crew up there and painstakingly sorted through all of this.